Today's reading is from Hebrews 11, verses 1 through 3. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Indeed, by faith our ancestors received approval. By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was made from things that are not visible. The word of God for the people of God.
Be to God. Thank you very much. And it's my privilege to introduce this first guest in our three-part series on faith in the real world. And we've been trying to sync this up so that people over in the chapel are on. And are they tuned in now? All right. So let's give a warm welcome to everybody who's over in the sanctuary right now participating with the service. It really is like we are able to be one big church today. So special Sunday as we kick off this series, interviewing different folks each week, because Brad Stevens and his wife Tracy and their children Brady and Kinsley have been members for a long time here at St. Luke's. It's been quite a decade for their family. 10 years ago, Brad was given his first head coaching opportunity at Butler University, and his career has just taken off in crazy ways. A few years after that, he took Butler to their first Final Four appearance, became the second youngest coach to take a team to the Final Four. The next year, they went back to the national championship, became the youngest coach to take a team twice to the national championship game. He has been nominated for more Coach of the Year awards than I can begin to name today. In 2013, he left Butler to go to Boston to be the head coach of the Boston Celtics, and in just 4 seasons, took them from the bottom of the Atlantic Division to this season, winning the regular season title for the Eastern Conference, number one seed in the playoffs, and was this year's head coach of the Eastern Conference in the NBA playoffs. I mean, it's just crazy the things that this guy's done. So we want to make Brad a little homesick for being back in St. Luke's and Indianapolis. So would you give the best, warmest St. Luke's welcome you know how to head coach Brad Stevens. All right, so we know who the real life of the party is Blue 3. And what a fun opportunity to give Brad and Tracy a little tearful homecoming back to St. Luke's and to Indianapolis. So we started the last time telling this story that I get a big kick out of. I want you to share that. You guys were running a basketball camp at Butler.
Yeah, we were running a basketball camp. A lot of your kids, or at least neighbors, probably came through that camp. We had, you know, close to 1,100, 1,200 kids a summer. And so, you know, the first or the Monday and Wednesday of the camp, we'd serve pizza. And the next day, I think it was maybe Chick-fil-A was our Tuesday and Thursday meal of choice. But the pizza day, Tracy and I would hand out the pizzas to the campers as they came through, and so it was maybe after the second Final Four at some point. I don't know if it was that year or the year after. And a lady and her daughter were visiting Butler. The daughter was a prospective student, and the mom came in and looked at me and said, "Man, you look familiar. Do we know each other?" And I said, "You know, I don't know, but." You know, "I've lived here all my life. Where do you live?" She said where they were from, and we kind of had some chit-chat. Never really got in, nor did it matter who we were. And she said, "Anyways, where do they keep that dog?" And so, you know, Tracy and I, we've got our gloves on because we're serving the pizzas the correct way. And so we just point over to on campus, and Mike Calton, Mark, and Tripp got another visitor.
The dog is the real show, and I like how Brad uses that as a lesson. In fact, my predecessor, Kent Millard, wrote a book about the Butler way and includes this in the chapter on humility, because Brad then says to his players, whenever your head gets big and you start to think people are here for you, just know there's a good many people here that care more about the dog than the players on the team, which I think is just a great line. Okay, so
and the coach.
I didn't ask you this last time. Just about coming back to Indy. Do you have any things you like doing when you come home?
You know, it's interesting. I could fill a schedule nonstop. In fact, we're right now and we've got two activities, you know, like this morning, and then we've got a fundraiser tonight. Last night we had a wedding with one of our former Butler players at a fundraiser yesterday in the morning. So we could fill every day but we really like to come back and you know, be as active as we can, but then take a step back and see our friends that are still here in town, and we've got quite a number of them. I was fortunate enough to grow up in Zionsville, go to DePaul University, coach at Butler, so first 33 years of my life were here. And so, you know, it's hard because you want to cross every T and dot every I, and we tried it. Like, the first couple times we came back to play the Pacers, I mean, I filled every meal, you know, did pregame meet and greets and all those things, and then a game broke out, and I learned real quick that, you know, when I come back, I've got to just keep it all business, and then when I come back in the summer, do as much as I can.
Any special restaurants or food? Do you get like Long's Donuts or anything when you come back?
Well, I like Long's Donuts, but we did what I ordered the chicken salad patichou every day for 7 years or 6 years when I was the head coach on Monday. So every Monday or Tuesday, you know, once a week, I'd order the same thing. I'd say, this is Brad. And they'd say, chicken salad, patchou, green tea. And so then 15 minutes later, I'd go pick it up and run through there and go back to Hinkle, the one on right on 49th Street. So yesterday, we called and ordered ahead, and that's what we had for lunch. And that's our favorite.
Got a little misty eating chicken salad, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Back home to Indy.
We've been trying to convince our friends that they'd be perfect where we live now. So maybe we can get Martha Hoover to open one of those up in Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Patichou in Boston. I bet it would go over well. Well, let's jump into this. 2013, you go from coaching Butler to the Boston Celtics. And I know you even mentioned that, you know, because you're not doing recruiting like you did as a college coach, in some ways life is easier. What about the pressure? Even though the pressure maybe didn't change a whole lot, just the pressure in general of being a coach, being in the public eye, people scrutinizing everything you do when you're in a game and on the court. What helps keep you balanced in that kind of life?
Yeah, I think it's that's a great question. The bottom line is scrutiny, praise, adversity, success. You know, there's a lot of external talk, which we call noise, that is really irrelevant in trying to prepare for the next game. And so all the time we're focused on what can we do to be the best that we can be today to help our team win? How can we add value to our team? How can we be a catalyst for each other on our team and raise the energy level in the room and stay in the mindset of being growth-oriented? It's really tough because everybody, whether they say it or not, has Twitter. Everybody reads the paper. Everybody, you know, can hear talk radio. It's just a matter of if you let that stuff affect you or not. And it goes both ways. I mean, you can get caught up in, it's not just the, you know, you're on a three-game losing streak and the sky is falling. It's just as, can be just as damaging to your team to get too caught up in your own success. And so I think the best thing you can do is just focus on doing a little bit better tomorrow.
Do you remember a time when things like turned really quick? Maybe when everyone was singing your praise and like, oh my gosh, Brad Stevens dropped out of heaven to coach basketball, but then just one little thing happened and it's like, that turned quick.
Every week in the NBA. I'm telling you. You think you're on good footing until, you know, you play the Cavs on a Tuesday, fly back home and play Golden State on Wednesday, you know, fly here to play Indiana on Friday, and you get too comfortable, you go on a losing streak pretty quickly. Things change quick, and it goes both ways. We always used to use the phrase when we were at Butler, you're never as good as you think you are, you're never as bad as you think you are, and you're never close from either, or you're never far from either, excuse me. And I think that is probably true.
I like that.
That's why you just have to stay on that even, hopefully, incline.
Never as good, never as bad, but you're never as far as you think you might be. So what's the biggest difference about coaching NBA players than college players?
Well, I think there's a few, I get asked that question a lot. And, you know, I saw Gordon's grandma in here, and you know, so some of them aren't that different from the standpoint of now I'll have a chance to coach one at Butler and then one with the Celtics. But I think ultimately all good players who are passionate about the game want to be coached as much as you can coach them. That is middle school, high school, college, NBA, my 11-year-old that likes the game. If they are passionate about the game and they want to be really good, then they really want to be coached, and they'll take it from anybody. Mm. And that's why I think one of our jobs is to make sure that we really study and do our best to put our best foot forward. There is no difference in coaching because those people that share those qualities all want to be coached. So it's funny because I've taken, you know, a lot of people talk about the money and how that changes people, or the extra scrutiny or the extra fame or whatever the case may be, and all the best ones. You know, nobody wants to be coached more on our team than Isaiah Thomas. Nobody.
Wow.
And, you know, he's asking for tidbits, thoughts, 12 months out of the year on how he can be a little bit better.
Nice. And the person you referenced a minute ago, grandmother of Gordon Hayward, who is the outstanding player for the Butler team, and you get to have him back as a Boston Celtic. That's got to be exciting to you.
I mean, it's incredibly exciting for me and for the Celtics organization and for Boston. But I also know that that was a really hard, arduous thing that he had to go through to make that call. And, you know, he couldn't have gone wrong. But at the same time, those are life decisions that, you know, you really have to weigh the pros and cons and everything else. And I know how much he struggled with it, but we're thrilled that he's going to join us in Boston. It's I said this yesterday, it was a little bit surreal to be sitting with him in a room trying to encourage him to think our situation was a really good one for him 10 years after doing it for the first time. The thoughtfulness and the questions and the back and forth and those things, he's obviously at a high level for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. And you've got this kid who played at Duke who's going to be with you this year, Jason Tatum. So you've got an interesting mix of talent. I didn't ask you this before, but some...
You did. You had to bring up the Duke part, right?
I know it's going to be a great year for you.
We took our team out to dinner and in the summer league, and we all had a nice dinner together and everything else, and I had everybody in on the joke that we were going to stick Jason with the bill, but we didn't. We didn't. But he's a really good kid. We're really looking forward to having him. He's a great representative of, and I give Duke a hard time, but Duke is, you know, obviously in the elite and one of the elite programs in the country.
So the first time I went and picked up Brad for lunch, I have a Duke tag on the front of my car, and I swing by Hinkle. He comes out and gets in. He just sits and goes. And I said, it's been a tough day. He goes, no, I just didn't think I'd ever be in a car with a Duke tag on it. It's taken a moment. Okay, so here's a question about coaching. What are fundamental beliefs you have about bringing out the best in players? Are there things you are just mindful of that you have to do to just draw the best in people out?
I said at the previous service, and Barry was up there with us a little bit, but nobody influenced probably my life in every which way, but certainly from coaching aspect more than my time with the coaches that I worked for at Butler, with Thad and Barry, and more so than anybody, probably Todd, my 6 years as an assistant with him. And he always, he looked at the world through, from a coaching perspective, through a different lens than a lot of people that I had grown up watching or talked to about basketball. You know, if the NCAA said you get 20 hours to practice, he didn't want to come close to 20. He wanted to figure out how we could do it in 10 to be the freshest team in the country when it was at the end of the season. He always thought of how can we be ahead of the curve by asking questions of why we're doing what we're doing. We only should be doing what applies to winning. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he used to talk about all the time, and it was from a book, and I don't know who wrote it, but it was called Soar With Your Strengths. And, you know, everybody is in, has a scholarship to Butler for a reason. Everybody is in the NBA for a reason. You know, sometimes I think we forget that because people get labeled as a bad passer or can't shoot or can't do this, can't do that. But they were in the NBA to begin with for a reason. And so there is a strength there that needs to be brought out. And our job as a team is to bring out each other's strengths. And that's why I like the idea. And one of my friends at Butler is writing a book about the idea of leading from within, leading from the middle, being a catalyst by soaring with your strengths, by doing your job as well as you can, and then hopefully everybody collectively reaps the benefits of collective success.
So when you have a player on the team, and I find this very interesting about reading about you, Brad, and I loved coming to a practice of yours to watch what you did. You might remember the first practice of the season in the 2011-2012, so you've just gone to two national championships. And you kind of laughed before and you said, we got seven freshmen. Who knows what's going to happen out there today?
Don't sit in the first five rows.
You said, balls are going to fly.
Because the balls are going to be flying all over the place.
Yeah.
You're more likely to break your nose as a spectator than a player that day.
Well, I watched you do something that really stuck with me because you obviously have a team value that when one goes down, everybody runs. One person falls, everybody comes to help them up. It just helps, I guess, build that sense of camaraderie being a team. So one of the freshmen, like, was hanging around half court when somebody under the bucket fell, and everybody sprinted, and he kind of looked around like, well, this looks weird. And I just watched you walk over to him, and you just said, hey, we have a value. When somebody goes down, we all run, all right? And that's all you said, and you walk back off. How do you deal with players who just aren't fitting into the system? Maybe they even come off, perhaps, like they do not want to fully buy into the values or what you're trying to do. How do you address that?
Well, again, really good players that really value competing, no matter, you know, we all have our own individual things that we need to improve on. Everybody does that, but they're all at the core going to be in for the collective good of the team. But everybody, again, has individual ambitions and desires. And so it's, I think a job of a coach is not to ride the wave of a person that is, you know, brings it every day and is one of the most unique players in the world, but more to help bring the best out of each guy that's in that room. And whatever the emphasis needs to be for each person, make that the emphasis. Again, that we have the best players in the world in the NBA. And so, you know, that's 450 of the best players in the world. And we all have days, coaches and players, where it doesn't go well for us. And to be able to respond with the appropriate mindset, to be able to stay the course and keep an even, you know, an even keel and move forward with the right approach is the most important thing. And I think that the best embrace that. Most of those guys are at that level.
Yeah.
And they figured out pretty quickly that it's really hard. Like you talked about, that team had seven freshmen. We have 60% of our team this year will be new, and five of them, I think, maybe six of them have never played an NBA game. And that's with a team coming back that was a pretty good team. So we've got a lot of work to do into not only helping get people up to speed with what we're trying to do on the court and how they can add value to winning, but also how they can manage the ups and downs of the long season. Because if you ride the roller coaster in an 82-game season emotionally and you get really high on a good night and really low on a bad night, that's too much roller coaster.
Yeah.
You can't just keep steadily climbing.
So something that from the television would appear to be a big difference with coaching NBA, when you're in college, you're recruiting the players. You're going after them. You're kind of saying, I want you on this team. You built a relationship. I'm sure in the NBA, you're still involved in the process somewhat, but not like that. Are there things you do to help players trust you or other coaches?
I think the coaches at this level are all unbelievable, but I don't think there's a monopoly of great coaching at any one level. So there's great high school, great middle school, great summer league, great whatever. There's great coaches in every at every level. And I think the trait that comes to mind for a great coach would be they're authentic. So they're themselves, right? They're not going to lead to somebody else's style. They're just going to be themselves, and they truly invest and care about each and every person on their team. One of the things that we did talk about in our first couple years at Boston, because we had a lot of turnover in those years. I think we had 42 players in the first 18 months.
Wow.
And we don't have anybody on this upcoming roster that was there in 2013. And we had a couple from this past year that unfortunately we lost because just the way that the salary cap works and everything else. But the end of the day was we wanted everybody to feel like when they look back on their career, whether they were here a month or whether they were here 4 years or 2 months, that was a place that really invested in me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, not everybody's going to have a great feeling about it when you're in a business and you're turning it over that quick. But, you know, we as a staff really tried to invest in the individuals.
So you're in a career where the ability to see inside of people and what's going on and bring the best out of them, I mean, it's just critical. Are there ways your faith impacts the way you look at people?
Well, I think one of the things is the way that faith impacts how you look at people is everybody's got a great value to add. You know, every person that I've come across that has been on our team has had a great value to add. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I was fortunate enough to work at Butler for 13 years, and I said this earlier, out of the two things that were probably most impactful to me outside of being in church as a kid or going and sitting in the back row back there when you were preaching, it was going on mission trips when I was in high school, and it was my 13 years at Butler, because everything was in our program based on, you know, making decisions on values. Those values were very biblical in nature and were actually, you know, passed down from other coaches, as we talked about earlier. And so we were really following a template. At Butler, everybody was so committed to trying to be as passionate as they could be, trying to be team first, serve others, be humble, in deflecting praise, but then also be thankful for every single opportunity, whether you're playing or not. And that was a large reason why I thought we were able to experience the success. We had really good players, and in some cases, great players.
Yeah.
But we had everybody was all in.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, you see, you know, with Brandon, Coach Holt, and now to Laval, it's we are so fortunate to coach, and Todd and Thad before us, in a program that has such strong base and such a strong foundation.
If you get the book by Kent Millard, you'll read the history about the Butler way and how that came from Barry Collier, who's now the athletic director, learning from Dick Bennett, his son Tony Bennett's coach at Virginia, and got stirred up by these values and then put scripture verses to them as he sought a way to apply his faith and what he believes about the important values of life with coaching. And so Brad came and poured into that even more. And I just think it's interesting to think about the faith influence on just your basic values of what do I believe about people? What do I believe about the values that God wants to build into people, how that gets shaped? So when you're watching things like how the Celtics respond to the death of Isaiah Thomas's sister at the start of the playoffs, you get everything filtered through sports analysts on TV. But just watching that, I got this sense like something special is happening in this unit of people, were there things that went on then that you just said, I saw values at work that made me really proud as a coach?
Yeah, I mean, we had two instances when I was at Butler where we lost, one of our players lost a parent on game day. And those were obviously very, very traumatic situations for the player and the team. So unfortunately, you have a little bit of something to lean back from an experience standpoint. So Isaiah's sister died the Saturday before we started the playoffs on Sunday, and he found out after practice, literally as we were walking off the floor, one of his teammates that was from the same neighborhood in Tacoma put his arm around him and told him that what had happened. And so Isaiah, you know, 28 hours later, we have a game against Chicago. Tracy and I go over to his apartment that night, and you know, we're pretty sure, like, there's no way. He needs to go home. Like, he needs to go back to Seattle. He was obviously beside himself. It was a very tough situation, obviously. But he really wanted to stay in Boston and be with his teammates, but also be in the gym. And, you know, we encouraged him to leave because at the time you could kind of see, like, he needed to go back and be with his family, especially his dad, who was really struggling. But he needed that. He needed to be comfortable. But it was a really hard time. You could kind of see for those 2.5 hours we were in the gym a day where he would try his best to compartmentalize, but he still had some really down moments. But it wasn't until he got a chance to go back home that I think he really felt like, okay, now I can come back and put my best foot forward for her.
Yeah.
And that became a real rallying cry for our team, and I think it was as much for him from our other teammates. And I think one of the things that was so impressive to me was we lost the first two games of that series, both at home, and we're the 1 seed, Chicago's the 8 seed. But we were operating at a really important level of perspective as a unit. Like, we knew those games were what we had worked towards the whole season, but we also knew that there were more important things in the world going on, specifically in our locker room affecting a teammate. And it was important for us to maintain the right mindset, maintain a good poise, be accountable for what we can do better on the court, but be there as a comfort for him and provide that sanctuary that the gym is. Like, for all of you that have been basketball players, and I see the Hills are over here. Chris Hill was a great basketball player at Michigan State, and I actually coached him in AAU when he was a young kid. And like, if you're a basketball player, that's where you want to be. When things are good or bad, you want to be in an empty gym. You want to be with your teammates, or you want to be by yourself in an empty gym. And so that was really his sanctuary. And so we wanted to honor that and make sure it was good for him. And when he came back from Seattle, you kind of sense that he felt like, you know, we were going to be able to, you know, do the best we can to focus on playing well. But, you know, at that time I was in good, you know, I felt really good about our team because we were emphasizing the right things.
So what do you believe about crisis? What do you believe about things when the bottom falls out, something bad impacts the team, adversity? Do you have basic beliefs about that?
Well, you know, and obviously, you live in a world where, and we're really fortunate, one of the reasons why the NBA is as strong financially as it is because it's covered by everybody all the time. And so you have to sensationalize every game. You have to use words like tragic loss after a basketball game, or that was a catastrophic week.
Yeah.
Like, no, that's not true. It's not tragic, and it's not catastrophic. We got a chance to correct this, right? And so, like, losing his sister is tragic. That's catastrophic. That is brutal, brutal, real-life adversity. Losing a basketball game's not. And so we operate in two separate worlds. And, again, I think that's where you try to block out, you know, any negativity or overreaction on the good side.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we're also not the end-all, be-all just because we won a couple games.
Right. Let me switch gears because we don't have a lot of time. I want to go back to how you got into coaching. And I know many of you know Brad's story, went to DePaul and graduated with an economics degree and took a position at Lilly and had all of the appearance of a career that was going to be safe and sound for a long road. And you would have probably done extremely well doing that. Walked away from it to take a position on the Butler coaching staff that was volunteer. Didn't even pay a dime. What gave you the gumption to do that?
Believe it or not, I was a 22-year-old idiot. No, I don't know. I mean, I followed my dreams and my passion and blah, 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 and so the story goes. I liked my job. I didn't love my job. I spent most of my free time looking for the next open gym game that I could go play in because I was an athlete that had just lost the opportunity to compete every day with his team. I had spent every other waking minute of free time looking at which game I could go to and scout as a high school for a high school coach, or if I go to a college game or a pro game or whatever. And I just wanted to be a part of the game. Basketball had always been a really important part of me, and I've learned as time has gone on that it's not basketball. It's team. It's the opportunity to compete. It's the opportunity to grow as a team. It's the opportunity to see teams get better. And then when all the chips are on the line at the end of the season, when you're in the NCAA tournament or when you're in the NBA playoffs, there's nothing more exhilarating from a competitive standpoint than being in those moments. I never got to do it as a player. And so, like, everybody always says, did you always know you're going to be a coach? No. Like, nobody wants to coach. Like, everybody wants to play. Like, I just wasn't good enough. And so, like a lot of players, the first next thing they look for is, well, how do I stay involved in the game? And I was fortunate enough to latch on to the Butler staff at the time as a volunteer under Thad Matta. And, you know, if I don't go there when Thad Matta is the head coach who leaves in a year, or Todd Licklider who leaves after 6 years, then I never get the opportunity. And so I was really lucky to be around the right people.
I do think it's a phenomenal story. In a 2010 New York Times interview with you, you talk about your neighborhood growing up. You're 8 years old. You get a basketball goal. Somebody else gets a goal. And that's where everybody hangs out. But you have this line I love that I discovered my dreams in the driveway. I discovered my dreams in the driveway. Now, that told me more than just about the fact that you had a basketball goal to play in, but it was about something around the nurture of home, having people in your life that encouraged you to dream. Who do you give credit for in encouraging your dreams?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, my parents, my friends, I was an only child, so putting that basketball goal up gave me a lot of brothers and sisters. You know, they all came. And, I talked about it earlier, Brian Flickinger, who was in the last session, ended up playing at LaSalle and playing with me at Zionsville High School. And, I mean, we play there all day, every day. And like I said about Isaiah, that becomes your sanctuary. That becomes, you know, even to this day, if I want to just kind of clear my mind, I might go out on my driveway now and shoot, you know, or go to the gym and just shoot by myself. And I think that that's just one of those things that, you know, whatever your passion is, for a pianist, it would be sitting down in their living room and playing the piano, or for, you know, whatever the case may be. And that was where that started for me. And so I remember more vividly being out there after tough losses and just being like, I'm just going to shoot all day. And those are fun, really fun, vivid memories.
Tracy, of course, you guys were dating at the time. You talked to her about this idea, and she said, well, she thought about it, and she said, go for it. And I just think about having people in your life who don't just pour cold water on your dreams. I mean, were there people who said to you, Brad, you're a nut. You're walking away from a great career.
Not to my face. I definitely had a grandparent say, I don't think this is a good idea. And that was to my face. And it was right when I decided to leave. I was actually doing a, we were doing a meeting in Phoenix, and I drove down to see my grandparents in Tucson, and my grandma, she was not comfortable with the idea. And, you know, a few years later, it was like, told you it was a great idea. You know, like.
She got on board with that idea pretty quick, didn't
by
she?
That, and by that time, I'm like, man, this is crazy. I don't know if this is a good idea to be in coaching. You know, like, so we had flipped. But yeah, it's great to have people. And then we talked about it earlier. Tracy ended up going to law school and pursuing her own dream, which, you know, kind of gave us both the lease to take a few years and see what happens. And, you know, we were lucky that it worked out for us.
She's got a great law career. She also happens to be your agent.
She does. And I said this earlier as well, so I apologize if you've heard this before, but I've said she reads all of the contracts whenever whether Butler or the Celtics. She actually goes to Harvard and does a class on or a one-day seminar with it. So I'm like begging, can we be a Harvard faculty or can we get a Harvard alumni sticker out of this deal somehow? I guess we're trying to squeeze through the cracks. But I always joke, she's the only agent in the country getting 100%.
Kind of
not quite 100, but it's more like 93. Yeah.
Sort of makes every spouse an agent, doesn't it? Yeah. So last service, we had Barry Collier here, who was the athletic director, is the athletic director at Butler, but the one who gave Brad that job and took a chance on him. Here's a question I didn't ask you. I'd ask it now. You had Barry there, other people in your life. Who do you owe the greatest thanks to in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's such a long list. I don't know where to begin. Obviously, you know, you always take a step back. There's always a bigger picture than you, and you start with your faith and your family and your dearest and best friends. You know, from a professional career standpoint, I wouldn't have gotten into the business without Thad. I would know nothing about coaching without Todd. And Barry gave me a chance. And so I would think that those three have been as impactful as anybody possibly could be on a young coach. And, you know, I tell, especially people going into coaching for the first time, 22, 23-year-olds that are really interested in doing it, it's not only important to get with a place that you feel really good about and can have some success if you continue to do it the right way, but it's about being around the right mentors. Like, I was raised as a coach well. You know, I could not have had better, you know, a more inspiring person to work for than Thad Matta, a more analytical, detailed, focused person than Todd. And then, you know, again, Barry hired me when I was 30. Like, and it wasn't, you know, I told you this earlier, like today, he interviewed us all, the three assistants, on a Tuesday night. On Wednesday morning, he said, I'm going to call you guys and let you know what I've decided. I have every suitcase packed to drive to Iowa City, and I'm driving in sweats to go be an assistant for Todd when my phone rings, and I'm in the Meridian Kessler area, and it was Barry saying, meet me here in 15 minutes. And I was like, I mean, it couldn't have surprised me more based on my interview the night before.
You were convinced.
I was convinced I was gone. I was going to Iowa City with Todd, and I was going to be an assistant, and I was studying their roster. I was studying how many scholarships they had because we were getting ready to go recruiting. And then stopped the car, got dressed in a suit on the side of the road, went and met Barry. Barry didn't say this part. We meet for like 3 hours talking culture mostly, maybe a little basketball. And then we have a celebration for our Sweet 16 team that day. And there's no speaker because Todd left. And so Barry just hands me the mic in front of a group like this big. And it was like, I think it was probably all part of the interview.
Wow.
And so I, you know, tried my best not to screw it up.
And that's how it happened. So I'm an invisible man, and I follow Brad Stevens around for a couple of months, and you have no idea I'm right on your shoulder. I would expect there are things I'm going to see. I'm going to see where you spend your time. Just from what I've read about you, a lot of it's going to be spent looking at game film. It's going to be spent reading. You read a lot. You're studying things. You're talking with people. So a lot about coaching. What am I going to learn about what you care about?
Well, I mean, anytime that we're fortunate enough not to be on the road from, you know, we'll be home and we'll be at dinner for that evening until our kids go to bed, and we've always really prioritized that. And I think you'd learn that we'd like to travel and do different adventures during the off season. And then you might also learn that, you know, I might dabble into a video game or a last minute tennis match or something else to just kind of get my mind off of the stress of it all.
So you spend time with your family, you take care of yourself. I ask you this, and we'll make this the last question. End of your life, we're having your funeral. What do you hope gets said about Brad Stevens?
Yeah, that's a really hard one, right? And it's funny because when I answered it last hour, I thought I was too wordy. So I think at the end of the day, you want to be known as a person that was a good member of the community, that was a good husband, a good father, and that tried to give their best effort.
One of the things I noticed when I first came to St. Luke's, I'd heard of Brad because I watched, of course, being a Duke fan, I watched that national championship when they played each other, and the only thing I remember is going, man, they've got a young coach. That guy looks really young. Here he is playing in the next one the next year. I get into discussions out of nowhere with people from St. Luke's and learn that he's the coach here. And every Sunday, I would see Brad and his family on the back pew. And there were some times I just thought, I know you did not get home until 2 in the morning from some East Coast Butler game, and you're here in church. And I ask you one time, what's the most important thing you need? You pointed a finger at me. You said, keep me faithful and inspired. Keep me faithful, keep me inspired. I want a chance to do that once again for this guy I think the world of, and he's a hero of mine. So I want to say a prayer for him and for his family, and let's join together. Gracious God, we thank you for Brad and for Tracy, for Brady, for Kinsley, for their family. We thank you for the example he sets in a busy, stress-filled career, showing by the way he lives, by his calm demeanor, that at the end of the day, it's the people around him who matter most, the way he cares for others, the way you show that compassion through all that he does, through his service in the world for cancer versus coaches, for other causes that his players and former players are about, the way that you will continue to use him and guide his steps, lead his family, protect them and watch over them as they not only continue to be faithful and inspired, but give the same to other people by your help. We pray this in the name of Jesus Christ, and all God's people said. Hey, would you join me once again in thanking Brad for being here?